Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, along with Greg Priddy.
Good evening. How are you?
I am sweltering. Yeah. Happily.
Yeah, as we said, we set our clocks forward an hour and our calendars ahead 2 months.
That's something new for Northeast Ohio. Let's tell the truth here. Rarely is it in the mid-70s in March.
Yeah, who knows how long it'll last, but we don't care.
We're going to take it while we got it.
That's right.
Yeah, they said it's going to keep on being in the 70s. I'm pretty happy. So we're actually in the same city at the same time for a change.
Yeah.
Yeah, this traveling thing is getting old. You know, the whole Washington, D.C., which I'm going to report on next week.
Okay.
I'm not doing it now. But anyway, how's your training going, Mr. Calvins?
Got the first century in, so we're on the way.
And how did that go?
Oh, you know, it was fine. It was fine. About what you would expect.
Oh, it's just a century in March. When the hell does that happen?
I'm six centuries behind some of these guys.
Well, but they're nuts. We know that.
They are at a different level. Let's put it that way.
That's true. Well, you know, the whole Calvin's crew, Jeff and the Calvin's people, are going to be on the show April 7th.
Oh, great.
Yeah. So
yeah, that's
going to
be fun.
Yeah, it will be. And this week's show should be pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. We actually have two people who have been in the industry as long as I have or longer. So we're all old together. It should be interesting to people who are new to bicycles, as well as those who have been cycling for many years. As you know, I recently returned from the 8th Annual North American Handmade Bicycle Show in Sacramento. And one of the people I wasn't able to actually talk to, other than to poke him and say, hey, looking forward to having you on the show, was Bruce Gordon.
Mm-hmm.
He was so mobbed every time I went by his booth.
Wow.
He was just glowing. He was so happy. So I have his full attention, I think, this evening. We're going to talk to him from his shop in Petaluma, which is a lovely little town, by the way, up in Northern California. And we also have a gentleman who can trace his roots in cycling all the way back to the 50s. That's the 1950s, not the 1850s. Rich Olkin's father, Ben, started the original National Bicycle Dealers Association in Boston, and his store, the BiEx, which is the Bicycle Exchange, was one of the best-known bicycle shops on the East Coast for many, many, many years. Rich kept up with the business, but along the way he got a law degree and an MBA. He was also the first director of Bikes Belong. And although now he's officially retired, right, like none of us ever seems to retire, he still has a lot of influence and knowledge. So we're going to talk to Rich this evening. And I'm really honored to have them both because they're both excellent, wonderful, interesting people.
Yeah, looking forward to hearing what they have to say.
Yeah, and we have some news.
Okay.
We actually have some interesting news this evening. I guess we should just bring them on.
Let's dive right in.
All right. Well, Rich Olkin, welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. It's nice to be able to talk with you this evening.
Oh, well, it's a privilege to talk to you, Diane. Thank you so much for calling.
Well, we've known each other a way long time.
It is a few years.
Yes. Just a few. You could add decades to that, actually. But your exposure in the bicycle business is even longer than mine. You grew up in the business.
Right.
Your background is bicycles. Tell us a little bit about your history and the history of your family.
Well, it really is my dad, you know, who started all this. He was a student at MIT in architecture he graduated in 1934, and it was the height of the Depression, or the depth of the Depression, I guess you'd say, and couldn't get a job as an architect, and he was an avid bicyclist, and he started selling used bicycles and so forth, and one link led to another. He got involved with Monroe and Isabel Smith, who started American Youth Hostels that same year, and he and his buddies rode all over New England opening youth hostels and getting people on a bicycle. He told me that amongst the first things he had to do was set up a little school to teach people how to ride bicycles, because in those days, bicycles had really fallen out of favor.
Interesting.
Yeah, and one thing led to another. He did bike trains. He did everything he could to get people on a bikes. And, you know, it became fairly successful. But he was really interested in better bikes. And so he was an early, well, he was the first Raleigh dealer in the United States. And he really liked the European lighter, higher performance, better quality designs and so forth. And right after World War II, he went to England, which was a real big deal at the time, around 1950, and he became the importer of Dawes bikes, which were really the first kind of high-zoot British bikes in our part of the country, anyway. And he kept on being developmental as he went along. And, you know, he always said that if we were going to grow the sport and the recreation of bicycling, we had to do it ourselves. And he taught me, you know, if you can't be a promoter and an advocate, you ain't going to have any customers.
Interesting. Even yeah. then, he knew.
Yeah. In 1947, he was amongst that bunch of guys who started the National Bike Dealer Association.
And that was it the Bicycle Exchange then, or did it have a different name?
No, we were the Bicycle Exchange from beginning to end.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. I actually had an employee who worked for you back in when I had City Bike downtown.
Wow, I keep running into my former employees.
I'll bet you do.
There's some wonderful, wonderful people, and they do all kinds of great things all over the world. So.
Yeah. So, okay, so now he's the Dawes importer, and he's got all these beautiful steel bikes.
Right.
Which have now come back into favor, by the way.
Yeah, beautiful stuff.
And wasn't he also the Univega importer?
Yeah, well, what happened was it was the great bike boom of the early 70s, and you know, just getting enough bicycles was really a problem. And he was contacted by his friend Ben Lowy on the West Coast. Lowy had been the Raleigh distributor out west before Raleigh took over the national distribution. And Lowy set up a deal with the Motobacon company in France to import their bikes, but he needed to buy more than he could sell. So he asked my dad to participate with him, and we started getting bikes from Motobacon, and that's where the real big part of our importation business started. And when it no longer was possible to get bikes competitively from France, we turned to Japan, as everyone else did, and, of course, Motobacon wouldn't let us use their name on Japanese-made bikes, so we made up the name Univega. Started as Italvega when we had Italian bikes, but we couldn't call Japanese bikes Ital. So
wait, your Univega was your brand?
Right.
I didn't understand that. Isn't that interesting? So can I ask you which factory made them?
Oh, they were made by a whole bunch of them.
The
first ones were made by Miata.
Okay.
And Miata made absolutely beautiful stuff.
Yes,
and then
they
we
did.
Had some of the lower line bikes, the cheaper ones and so forth, were made by KHS and Southern Cross and a few other companies in Taiwan. And, you know, when that had to happen.
I had no idea. It's so exciting. I get to learn things all the time. Every time I do this show, I learn something new. I love it. And I certainly don't know everything. That's for sure. So things have changed so much.
Right.
Do you think anything's been lost with the everything looks alike carbon right now?
That's hard. Let's see. You know, I was visited a bike dealer friend of mine yesterday because, you know, it's starting to be warm. We didn't have a winter here. And
I know. We haven't
really
either.
My riding group is having our first ride of the year on Sunday. And, you know, so I had to, you know, smell the rubber in the oil, you know. So I went out to Harris Cycle. We out in Newton. And they had some Rivendells and, you know, just some other things like that. They're so gorgeous. You know, that's sculpture.
Right.
But I myself ride a carbon bike, and I'll tell you what, it was a real eye-opener to me.
Well, it's...
the performance, the just everything about it, it just rides so beautifully, you know.
It's interesting you say that. I was on a panel at NABS last week, and...
Uh-huh.
You know, with Richard Sachs and Craig Kalfi, and it was a really interesting group of people.
Hmm.
And that's what came up, that today's bicycles are so awesome in so many ways.
Right.
And yet, here's this resurgence of the classic steel lugged frame bike. It's just interesting to watch sort of both ends of that spectrum coming up.
Well, I don't know if you recall, but when I was doing Bikes Belong, and it was 2000, and as a kind of tongue-in-cheek thing, I officially named the bicycle as the invention of the millennium. And I got a tremendous amount of response about it, much more than I had expected, especially a lot of flack from people saying, you know, what about the sextant and the compass?
Right,
and
of course.
Like that. But, you know, when you think about it, what is more perfect than a bicycle? I mean, and the ones that were made, you know, the first safeties of the 1890s or late 1880s, we had a Singer cross frame of about 1884. It was gorgeous. Sure, the materials have improved and, you know, stuff is not, every little bit doesn't have to be custom made. But that product was perfect, you know, and it's just been refined and refined. Well, now we've gone to new, you know, sort of space age materials, but it's still that same simple thing. How do you take a human being and amplify his ability? It's
right.
Incredible.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, what's interesting is that you have taken all of your education and all of your background and kept it in the bicycle industry a lot of the time. Now, not all of the time, because I know you're doing some other things.
Yeah.
But for the most part, you've been involved in the bicycle business your whole life.
Yeah, I did go to work for my dad in 1958. So what does that make? 53, 54 years?
Yeah. I thought you were only 40.
Yeah, I'm only 40X.
40 to the X. I get it. Yeah, like me. Very good. Very good. Let me take a moment to remind our listeners we're speaking with Rich Olkin, who is in Boston. Are you in Boston?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, in Boston, Massachusetts. One of just the most sought after bicycle people, if you really want to know something about the industry, because he's been around it forever and ever from a good point of view. So... What
making me feel old.
Yeah, we're both old. We're not going to talk about old. You became president of the NBDA, National Bicycle Dealers Association, what, in 1984?
1984 and 85, yeah.
So fast forward to the NBDA today and tell me what you see as the difference between the bicycle dealer then and the bicycle dealer now.
Okay, well, what I will say is, the enthusiasm for the product and the customers and the thrill of cycling, the competition, the recreation, still there, still the same. But I see much more savvy, I'll call it, product savvy, business savvy. I mean, people are getting it. You know, it used to be a business that any shade tree mechanic who didn't want to work for somebody could get into if he just had a wrench and stood in his backyard and had the neighbors come over and he charged them a few bucks to fix their bikes.
Right.
Now you see professionals, but they haven't lost that soul, that spirit of why it's so great to be in the bike business as compared to, say, you know, selling garbage disposals. You know, it's just a product that you love. The customers get so enthusiastic, and that keeps the dealers happy. But the dealers have also learned to count their pennies, and that's so important. And the other thing I will say, and it was a long, long time in coming, that the manufacturers have finally realized that the dealers have got to have some margins. They've got to be able to live. And, you know, it can't all be, you know, give the manufacturer the profit and the dealer can just, you know, live off his repairs. You know, now people can make products. And, of course, we have such a beautiful, beautiful array of add-on accessories that make bicycling so nice and so much fun. I mean, you know, they're just wonderful things that didn't exist. You know, it used to be all you could get was, you know, a luggage rack and a basket and a battery light.
Now and a kickstand.
A kickstand, yeah. And now there's just an array of things, clothing and tchotchkes and electronics and, you know, just everything to make bicycling whatever the rider wants it to be, and that's just fun.
That's all true, and I would not disagree with one thing. The thing that I see happening, though, is that now the bike dealer is up against a whole new, I don't want to call it enemy, but certainly an obstacle in the form of online sales. So now we're kind of fighting something new, and yet you are the computer guy. You're the guy who said, get your data under control here.
Well, it's true. I always felt like you know, you need to have a handle on your numbers and your business. And, you know, I come from, you know, a slightly different background than a lot of dealers. But, you know, I grew up in the business, so I could see both the technical side and the business side of it. Online is a problem. Online is a problem because, you know, it's a great service. People can buy things cheap. But, you know, bicycle dealership is a service relationship business. And the problem is, of course, that we used to worry about mail order and this and that. Online is much more, I mean, I hate to characterize it negatively, but it's much more nefarious to the dealer because, you know, you get people who buy things on price, and then the dealer has to stay in business. I remember my old buddy Harley Phillips, who's a terrific, wonderful guy, a bike dealer out in Hutchinson, Kansas, who was really kind of, you know, for a plain-spoken country guy, he was really one of the brains of the bicycle industry. And, you know, he always was pushing the fact that if you don't make your margins, and you don't sell stuff, you know, you can't stay in business. And when customers come into him and say, well, gee, Harley, you know, why should I spend, you know, $5 here when I can get the same product for $4.50, you know, a mail order on the line? He said, well, you know, someday you're going to want service and you want me to be here. Now look at all my other competitors who've come and gone because they try to cut prices and try to compete with. He said, if you want service and if you want somebody to be there when you need them, unfortunately, you got to give them some business. So do that.
Oh, I remember.
I agree with that 100%.
Harley used to do the profitability seminar, and he did it every year, and it was as clear as the little chart he put up. And people think profit is a dirty word.
Yeah.
But if you don't make profit, you're not going to stay in business. So it's tough. You know, we've been through a lot of stuff with this online thing. It's different from having them wave the NASHBAR catalog in your face, but it's you remember that, I'm sure.
Different, but it's the same.
Yeah, exactly. So let's talk about advocacy, because you are an advocate for the bike.
Yep.
Do you go to the bike summit still?
I haven't been for a few years because other things have come up, and you know, I don't want to be dead weight. And the other thing is, of course, my impetus to go to them is somewhat less because all of my members of Congress in my state vote for bicycle stuff all the time.
Right. Well, that's because you're in Massachusetts.
Yes, and I don't have to go beat them over the head as much.
Well, unfortunately, the Speaker of the House is in my state, so yeah. we have a lot bigger obstacle in our way.
But the problem is that a lot of these opponents confuse the fact that bicycles, yes, are sporting goods, yes, are recreational. And they think that somehow makes them non-transportation. And, you know, it's just a bad mode of thinking. That's my feeling about it. Now, what can we do? Well, I think we have to just keep going. I mean, I think the Bike Summit this year is ultra, ultra important. I have been thinking about going down there at least for the lobbying day just because it's so important to do it. I mean, I look at, you know, I had the great, great privilege of introducing the concept of Safe Routes to School to Jim Oberstar, who then put it into the form of law language. And when I look at what people like Deb Hubsmith and the people in Marin County and SusTrans and people around the country who have been implementing great things on Safe Routes to School, I think, how could anybody in Congress think that this isn't a bargain and a half?
Really?
You know,
really?
It's the closed-mindedness that, you know, and right now, you know, when I was lobbying, yes, I had to speak a different language to Democrats and to Republicans. The Democrats, you talk about, you know, what it's going to do for the community, blah, blah, blah. And for the Republicans, you talk about how this was self-sustaining and really wasn't going to cost more than it was going to be worth, et cetera. But now it's just so polarized that, you know, they don't talk about reality. They don't talk about the issues. They just talk about the positions. And that's just a sad, sad case for America.
I would definitely agree, and hopefully we'll get something done on Capitol Hill in a couple of weeks here.
Oh, I think so. I think, I'm going to tell you a little anecdote. I hope I'm not being too windy. But
not at all.
Back in 1984, there was another legislative flap, and that was a bike company called Murray of Ohio. They were in Tennessee at the time, and they had a congressman named Bill Bonner. And they convinced him to propose legislation that would have slapped heavy, heavy import taxes, 24%, on all bicycle products made outside the United States, and that included a number of categories, for example, derailleurs, that had no comparable product being made in the United States. So the naive guys from the bike industry, Steve Reddy and myself, went down to Washington. We raised a few hundred bucks from, you know, guys like Harry Manko and Raleigh and Schwinn. I mean, they came across and they paid our way down, and we didn't know any better, you know. So we just went down there and we said, what are we going to do? And they said, well, you know, we will have to hear from you about this. So Steve and I put on a campaign, and we got bicycle dealers to write letters, to tell their customers what was going on, to say, you know, this is unfair. You don't want Campagnola products to double in price just because Murray of Ohio is trying to get a drop on companies they don't even compete with, really.
Right, exactly.
And so we did this. And so we went back. Steve and I went back down to Washington and to meet with the committee, the subcommittee of taxation where this bill was going, because we didn't know who to talk to or what. And they said to us, they listened to our spiel, you know, oh, we think it's bad, blah, blah, blah. And they said, sit down right here. We'll be back in a minute. And they came back with a couple of big boxes of letters. And they said, see these boxes? And I said, yeah. Said, these are full of letters from bicycle dealers talking about how they don't like this bill. I said, yeah, is that a lot or a little? And she said, this is more letters than we got for the big steel tariff bill, which affected 800,000 jobs. Tell your bike dealers, leave us alone. The bill will never pass. You guys win. Just get out of here.
And what a great story.
It taught me that you got to speak up for yourself.
What a great story.
And the Bike Summit is fabulous because, you know, 500, 600, 800 people go down there and talk to every congressman. And what we used to say is a personal visit was worth 100 letters, and a letter was worth 100 emails. So if you visit, that's like 10,000 emails.
Exactly.
And you get 800 people there, that's 8 million emails.
Well, and the truth is that now when we go down there with our little neon bicycle pins, everybody knows why we're there.
That's right.
It's so interesting. It's, what, 11 years now? Everybody knows why we're there.
God bless Earl Blumenauer and his little bicycle pin.
Yeah, he's a sweetheart.
You know, I was privileged to be in the right place at the right time. Again, not knowing what I was doing, I said, let's have a lobbying day on Capitol Hill. And we had, at that time, I think 22 people, I remember. And we went around and we talked to, you know, whoever we could. We talked to a bunch of congressmen and senators. You know, we had a good vibe, and it was great. But Jody Newman, who at the time was the head of the League of American Bicyclists, said to me, gee, you know, Rich, it's great you're doing this, but you really need some professionalism here. Get organized. And she took it over and made the Bike Summit. So I started this Bike Lobby Days idea, but LAB made it into the Bike Summit, and they have done such a fantastic job. I mean, you know, what the way it is today, it's just super. I mean, even after 2 or 3 years, it became just a must-do event.
I agree, and not enough bicycle dealers go down there.
Well, more and more. I mean, I hear from more and more of them all the time.
That's good.
At the Interbike, you know.
So I want to take one other lane down the bicycle path with you, and that is to the library that is being built. So this is going to be sort of the legacy of your family.
Well, you know, it was a great opportunity. This hostel, youth hostel, of course, my father was, as I mentioned, one of the first youth hostelers, practically a co-founder of it in 1934, always believed in, you know, travel as educational and good for the world, and especially bicycle travel. And he endowed the previous hostel. There was a hostel in Boston. There is a hostel in Boston now that's about 250 beds, but it's kind of low profile and very poor facilities for what, you know, modern travelers need. And so we're building a new hostel here in Boston. It's going to be 468 beds, and it's right in a beautiful, visible location right in downtown, and it's near the Theater District in Chinatown, and it's Boston Common, and, it's great. So people from all over the world are going to come here, and we're going to have Andrew Prescott, who does, urban tours?
Yep.
Urban Adventures is going to run bike tours for these people, and, of course, we now have one of those bike rental systems that so many cities have, and it's been super successful here in Boston, and there's going to be a rental stand right in front of the hostel, and it's going to be great. Well, so my parents had named the living room at the old hostel because they had donated the money for that, and I wanted to continue their name in the new hostel, and the opportunity that we had was for the library, and I brought it up to my brothers and all our children and grandchildren, and they all signed on. And I'm happy to say that a lot of our, not only my, those, close relatives who just love Grandpa and Grammy, but also a bunch of my cousins and a bunch of business people who were associated with my dad have been very generous about this. We're working now toward a major sponsorship, hopefully, from a bike company. We hope to be able to do something about that within the next couple of months, but it's been very successful so far.
And so it is the Ben and Rose Olkin Library at the new youth hostel in Boston.
Right.
And that's so awesome, Rich.
And,
awesome.
my one major job outside the bike industry was at Harvard University, and among other things that I oversaw there was the writing and publishing of travel books called the Let's Go series, Let's Go Europe, et cetera. And my friends and former students and so forth are donating the entire Let's Go series to the library, along with a lot of video stuff and stuff. So we'll have a real nice low-cost travel library there.
Wow. Isn't that cool?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's real heartwarming to do this.
Sure it is. Sure it is. Well, wow, we could probably just schmooze for the rest of the day. There's so much going on in your life.
Yeah.
Well, I really, really enjoyed talking with you this evening.
Well, thank you so much. It's always great to talk to you, and I'm just so pleased that we ran into each other at Interbike last September. It was just like, wow, hey.
There she is.
Yeah.
So, well, I will catch up with you this year again at Interbike, and have a wonderful evening.
Thank you so much. It's great talking to you. And
you too.
I've been listening to your show on the podcast, and you do such a wonderful job.
Thank you.
I'm so pleased.
I appreciate that.
It's a privilege to be on with you.
Thank you. Have a great night.
Thanks, man. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Rich Olkin joined us from Boston, Massachusetts.
I really like Rich. He and I have known each other so long.
As we said on a previous show teasing that interview, he's been in the bike business since before he was born.
Right, exactly.
through his parents.
Right.
Wow. Well, I'm going to have to make an executive decision on you, Diane.
I don't do it
very often, but I'm going to have to cancel the news for this week.
Again. Well,
that's okay.
When you get people like Rich Olkin and Bruce Gordon, I'm sure is going to fill up the back end. So.
Yeah, well, it's a good problem to have.
Yes, it is.
All right, let's take a break.
Okay.
And when we come back, we have none other than Bruce Gordon.
That is correct.
Right after this on The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
Steven.
Who said that?
Me, down here.
Oh, what are you, a yellow booger?
I'm a banana slug, Steven.
What are you doing in my room?
I'm your sense of adventure. It's been a long time since we've had an adventure in the forest.
Mom took me to the forest last year.
I'm a slug, Steven. It took me a long time to get here.
You're right. I should get out.
Yeah, the forest is not that far away.
Hey, Mom!
Come to the forest where the more adventurous you lives. Check out discovertheforest.org for cool places nearby. Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
I'm Greg Pretty.
And I'm Diane Lees.
And we are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. And without any further fiddling around here, let's just jump right into our interview for the second half of the show.
Absolutely. I'd like to welcome Bruce Gordon to The Outspoken Cyclist. Bruce, thanks for joining us this evening.
Thank you for having me on.
It's been a long time. I've been trying to get you to come
on. Yeah, I know
you have. And I'm very pleased that you did.
Great.
We didn't really have a chance to talk at the Handmade Show because your booth was always packed with fans.
Yeah, there were a lot of people there.
There were. It was a big show. How was the show for you this year?
You get to talk to a lot of people. Financially, it's not great. Other than that, it's a wonderful social event. I saw people who I haven't seen in 30 years. Chris Chance looked exactly the same as...
Oh, my God, I didn't see him.
Yeah, Chris Chance was there. He walked up to the booth, and I said, you're Chris Chance. You don't look any different than you did 30 years ago when the last time I saw you.
If I had seen him, I would have probably said the same thing, because I would recognize him in a second.
And it turns out he's doing massage therapy or something like that 25 miles from here and has been living here for a long time. I think he sort of escaped the bike business.
Yeah, well, you know what? Some people get out, and some people like you and me don't seem to be able to do that.
Right, right.
So tell our listeners a little bit about your background, where you came from, what your education is, and then how you decided to make the left turn, evidently, into the bike business.
Well, I was born in Chicago. I went to school in Chicago. I went to Ferris Bueller's Day Offs High School.
Oh, cool.
I was into photography then. I went to undergraduate school in Southern Ohio, Ohio University. I have a BFA in art. I then went started graduate school at the Art Institute of Chicago in photography, and I made it through a quarter of the program and decided that I was going to move to California and start a bike shop. And I moved to California in 1970, 71. I lived in L.A. for about 6 months, worked at a bike shop, moved to Berkeley, worked in a bike shop there. 1974, Albert Eisentrout gave some frame building classes. I took one of those. I really wanted to get into that. I liked making stuff. I became part owner. I invested all my money, and we went from six people making 50 bikes a year to 10 or 12 people making 700 bikes a year.
Wow.
That lasted for about 2 years, and in 1976, we came to a parting of the way. And I moved to Eugene, Oregon, and started Bruce Gordon Cycles. And I was in Oregon till about 88. Then I moved back down to Petaluma, and I've been here ever since.
So when we spoke a month ago, several points came up consistently in our conversation, and you and I talked on the phone for a couple of hours. And one is your feeling that today people don't make things themselves.
Right.
And that it is just as important that people who buy things know where they were made. And
exactly.
So tell me more about that.
Well, I mean, I'm sort of old-fashioned. I'm going to be 64. I remember when there were three television sets available. They were all black and white. They were all made in America. There's Magnavox and RCA and Zenith and one other I don't remember. Now try to buy a TV made here. So we've become a nation that really makes nothing, and I'm sort of old-fashioned. If I needed to buy a table, I would go to a guy who makes tables, as opposed to the norm is if you want to buy a table, you go to IKEA and you get a thing that you sort of bolt together crudely. We've Mark Norstad of Paragon Machine Works and I were coming back from one of the first Euro bikes in Germany in Friedrichshafen, and that was where we got the idea to form Sopwamptos, which is the society of people who actually make their own blanks,
stuff.
But it's stuff.
We know what it is.
Yeah, and we did it for a couple years. It was sort of fun, kind of, we gave out toilet seats, used toilet seats as awards, and everybody loved them, and it became so much work that we didn't do it. Sean Walling from Soulcraft did it for about a year, and then he said, wow, this is a lot of work, and we said, yeah, it's a lot of work. About 8 months ago, I was talking with a friend who was in on the early days, and I was sitting at my computer, and I did a Google search for the word Sopwamptos, and actually came up with 25 pages of pages.
Really?
Everybody seemed to want to be Sopwamptos. So at the same time, I searched for Sopwamptos.com, and it was not taken. And so I invested $11.97 and bought the URL. And we sort of have a cross between a blog and a web page.
Well, I remember you guys used to make a big entrance into the show. And you had fezes on and carrying these gold-painted used toilet seats.
Yeah.
I used to crack up at that because
it was. I don't know if those are coming back. The main thing is, that's the most important to me is is the actually making your own stuff.
Yes.
Or you know, or the society of people who actually make their own stuff. Because nowadays we have become a nation where, you know, in the bike business, when I started, you couldn't give a bike away from Japan.
Right.
Then Japan became the hotbed. Then that became too expensive, so everything went to Taiwan. Then Taiwan became too expensive, so now most of the things come from China. So what you have is you have a whole series of people involved in this, and ultimately what you end up is you're paying less than usually 10 to 12, maybe 15% of what you pay is what the person who actually made the product is actually getting.
If that much.
It's very typical in the bike business to I spoke with someone from Cane Creek, a friend of mine, and you know, I said, if something costs you $5 to have made, a headset, for example, if it costs $5 at the factory in Taiwan for you to buy it, how much does it retail for? And he said, well, you know, I did the math, and it was $35. That's seven times.
Yes, it is.
You know, most frame builders and people who make stuff themselves, we would feel really guilty if we doubled our money.
Well, I'm not sure that guilty is a good thing, but I do understand, and we get this all the time being a custom shop.
Yeah.
I don't think people like the word profit, and yet you can't stay in business if you don't
right.
make a profit.
Right. Yeah. I mean, people have labeled me as negative and, you know, a complainer and all. And, you know, the bottom line is I really like making stuff. I really like making bikes. I like thinking about bikes. I like making them. I like riding them. I like improving them. But like I said, over the past 20 some years, I've attempted three times to have some frames made in an effort to get them less expensive, having frames made overseas. Two times I had them made in Japan, and about 4 years ago I had some made in Taiwan. Every single time has been a nightmare. Bottom line is the people over there in the factory are not your friends.
Aha. Uh-huh.
You know, I have had, every time that I did it, friends of mine in the industry who were in, you know, product managers and people who had experience doing this said, well, you're going to be at the factory when they're making your bikes. And I'm fairly innocent, naive about it, and I said, why? You know, I gave them a spec sheet, I gave them drawings, I gave them tolerances. None of what I've wanted was very exotic or, you know, complicated for a factory that makes, for example, the factory that made my bikes in Taiwan the last time, they were a small factory. They made 300,000 bikes a year.
Jeez.
And
small.
They, you know... And every time I made them and every time I had a problem, people said, well, to a certain extent, it's your fault because you weren't at the factory or had a representative at the factory when you have had your bikes made.
Wow.
The last version that I had were made with a local guy who has a bike shop named Mike Varley, who used to be the product manager for Haro and Mozzie.
We stopped by his shop. He's in Point Reyes Station.
He's very, you know, and I went through that with him. I said, Mike, I said, do we need to go to Taiwan when they're making the bikes? And he said, no. It took us 2 years to get the prototypes the way they were, and he didn't think it was necessary to go there. Well, as a result, the bikes were not right, and they had to be made right, remade in some kind, in some aspects. I won't get into that. But, you know, the difference that I always talk about, it's like it's very common for knowledge for anybody in the manufacturing field to say, well, you have to be at the factory when they're making the bikes. Well, my answer to that is if you buy a bike from me or you buy a bike from Steve Belinky or you buy a bike from Soulcraft or any of the people there at the hand-built show, you wouldn't expect to have to be at the factory when he was making your bike to make sure he did it right.
That is true. That is true. Let me take 1 second to remind our listeners we're speaking with Bruce Gordon, who's out in Petaluma, California at his shop and talking with us this evening. That is very true. So if you couldn't be at the factory,
mm-hmm.
what would be the right way to get a handmade bicycle made, or a custom bicycle even?
Well, to me, the right way is to go to the person who made it, just like the table. You need a table, you go to a guy who makes tables.
Okay,
I see. You don't necessarily need to have a whole bunch of middlemen in there. The typical thing in the bike business is, someone manufactures it, who sells it to someone who is just marketing it, who sells it to a distributor,
right,
who sells it to a bike shop, who sells it to the retailer. And by that time, something that's $5 becomes $35.
Right.
If you can buy stuff, it used to be how you would get to things would be kind of difficult because you almost had to be in bike shops. Nowadays, I have the feeling that if an old codger like me can order stuff on his iPhone, over the Internet, that you can do that. And by doing that, you can eliminate most of the markup. So what the consumer is getting is they're getting more for their money. They're not buying a bunch of marketing.
Well,
you don't ride the marketing.
Well, while that's somewhat true, I can say that the bicycle shops are struggling with that whole concept of, just look it up online and order it. And
sure.
So what people like we've done are cut out things like jerseys and shorts and gloves and shoes and the things that they would come in and shop and then pick up their phone and order it from Amazon.com or
right.
whoever.
Right.
So we're back to hard goods, the things people will make themselves,
right.
hopefully.
Now, I mean, that's my self-interest is, I agree with you. I don't think that, don't get me wrong, that I'm thinking that bike shops have an easy way to go. I know that bike shops don't make a lot of money. I know that people, especially these days, will come in and, try on pairs of shoes for 3 hours and then find out what size and then order it online. And
they've always done that, though.
Well,
that's
yeah.
not new, really. Well, so let's talk a little bit about handmade. The difference between, and I don't know if you're making this distinction, the difference between handmade and custom. Is there a difference between them?
Well, I mean, custom is one step further. We make most of what my business has been for the past 20 years, 30, 25 years, has been making loaded touring bikes and racks and things like that.
Right.
I make standard models of our Rock and Road, which is a TIG welded bike that's made here. I make standard sizes. In some cases where people don't fit in that, I will do a custom one, which takes a little more time in discussing the fitting. But the end product is, it's not a better made product. It's just, the additional time in fitting. I just spent building a bike for a soldier in Germany, and I probably had 40 emails and two or three phone calls, and I only did it because he was a soldier and
right.
Overseas. But his is a custom bike. It costs $250 more for the custom one off thing. But the difference between custom and handmade, custom means that it's made to your measure. Handmade means that it's the same quality. It's just sort of a stock size.
Got it. So somebody could order a handmade bicycle regardless of whether it's custom.
Yeah.
Okay. And that. So I guess I didn't realize you are still making the Rock and Road. Are you making the BLT?
Well, the BLT sort of was originally a Japanese version, then it became a California-made BLT that we made here, and then the BLT became the Taiwanese version that we had, the frame that we had made in Taiwan. So nowadays, there's really not much difference in between a Rock and Road and a BLT that we would make here. So we make them all Rock and Roads, and then we, the difference probably would be the parts package. So essentially, the BLT, the basic loaded touring, has kind of morphed into the Rock and Road Tour, and we have standard stock sizes, and then which we make in both 26-inch wheels and 700C, and then we make custom ones, which, if someone needs a shorter top tube or a longer top tube or whatever, that kind of stuff.
Well, you just brought up wheels, which brings up your new tire, which isn't your new tire. It's an old tire brought back. Why don't you tell us about the evolution of this cool tire, because it is a cool tire.
Yeah, back in 1988, when I first moved here, I became friends with Gary Helfrich, who I think I heard a report that you did with him.
Yes.
He was the titanium person. When I moved here, I went from building frames up in Oregon, which were 100% lugged frames. And I went to down here. I moved into the salsa shop and was in Petaluma. And Ibis was here. Gary Helfrich was here. Paragon Machine was here. And so everything sort of changed from 100% lugged frames to 100% TIG welded frames.
Right.
That was what they did. Mountain bikes. I came at it, the bike business from a road standpoint. I was not a mountain bike builder. And Gary Helfrich found a tire that was made by Nokia in Finland, I believe.
Right.
It was a great big heavy black big tire, and it was a 700C tire. And so we ended up building some bikes around that. And Gary and I had this argument over. He thought that everything should have flat mountain bike bars, and I said, well, things should have drop bars. And so we developed a way to switch the bars. And then the next thing was big tires. You know, the Nokia tires were big and off-road capable, but they weren't very light. They were very heavy black wall, heavy wall tires. So I looked into having a tire made, and Joe Murray, a famous mountain bike racer at that time, was in the area on and off, and so he had designed or done some technical drawings of tires. So he actually did a drawing of the tire, which we modified slightly. We made it a little bit bigger, a little more rounded, but basically the tread was the same as the finished tire. And so we had some tires made in Taiwan at that time. They were made by Chang Shin. I still have the original drawing that Joe Murray made, which shows how things have changed. This was done in 1988, and it was a pencil technical drafting that we sent to Taiwan.
And now, of course, it's
now,
going to come out of a computer CAD.
Now, of course, everything is like, you know, CAD
sure.
drawing and
sure.
everything. So, you know, the tires, you know, at that time, there was an import tariff on bicycles with a tire wider than 4 centimeters. And our tire was 4.3 centimeters. And so the import duty was 5.5%. But if the bicycle could take a tire wider than that, then the import duty was 11%.
Holy
well,
smokes.
To me, that didn't sound like a whole bunch of anything. But, you know, I ended up talking with some people at Bianchi, and because they were starting to make big 700C tires, and they said no, there was no way they were going to make them to fit these big tires. Even though the big tires worked well, they were going to make them to fit smaller tires because of the 5.5% import duty. And at that time, an expensive bike from Japan probably cost $400, so you're talking a difference of $20. But the standard person in the product management or product development guys, they take and they say, if a bike costs us $20 more, it's going to cost
$80 more, probably.
Yeah, it's going to cost $120 more.
Yeah, or whatever, right.
Right, right. right.
And it misses the price point at that point.
Exactly.
Right.
So they made the bike. So we went and had those tires made, which really only fit our rock and road. And I think there was one very unusual Gary Fisher model that they fit, but for the most part they didn't fit anything. And so then a few years later, when everything was going to rock shocks and they were all 26 inch shock forks, I was saying, well, why don't we make a 700C rock shock, you know? And so I have a small CNC machine which I had bought, and a friend of mine who worked for Paragon helped me program, and we made a fork crown with more slope to it and a brake arch that would bolt to the standard RockShox, I think it was a Mag 21 legs.
Wow, that's a blast from the past.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we made 700C RockShox. And that, you know, then all of a sudden everything became 29er this, 29er that.
Right.
Nobody had ever heard of the rock and road tire was a 29er tire before 29ers were 29ers.
Exactly.
And so last year I made a 29er, and nobody, you know, I made it as a city bike because it was a single speed, and I wasn't young enough to ride that off road. And so I rode with some Schwalbe tires, I think some big fat tires, and thought they were big and fat and heavy and didn't ride very well, and so I remembered that I had one or two sets of the Rock and Road tires that were 20, 23 or 24 years old, and so I put them on that and showed the bike at Interbike, and everybody just freaked out on the tire. So now what we're going to do is we're going to I should have samples probably by the end of the month. The tires are being made in Japan by Panaracer. Panaracer has several different factories, but their top of the line tires come from Japan. They will be exactly the same tread pattern. I sent them one of the tires and I said, "This is what I want to make. I just want to make it in Japan." It has a Kevlar bead. It's a 700 by 43 tire.
So it'll fold.
It's a folding tire. Yeah,
yep.
Yeah. And it's not as aggressive a tread, and it's not as big as some 29ers. But nowadays there are lots of bikes which will fit a 29er tire. So I'm hoping that that'll be something that I can do, and we will be selling maybe through bike shops. But if we were to sell them the normal bike shop scenario or the normal distributor bike shop retailer kind of scenario, they would probably be a $70 tire, which is what similar tires are.
Yeah.
We're going to be offering them. I'm not Mother Teresa, but I feel that the customer should get more for their money than just marketing, and so we're going to sell them direct to the consumer, and hopefully that'll work.
Well, if it works, that's a good thing.
Yeah.
Any other products in the offing?
Well, I make lots of different stuff. I've the French the classic bike people talk about the French being constructeurs, who made things. René Elsé and Alex Sanger and all they were constructeurs. Well, they didn't make most of the stuff that they sold. Sanger and Elsé never made cranks. They were made by somebody who made cranks. I, by comparison to that, I have made. Well, I make bicycles, I make racks, I make stems, I make toe clips, I have tail lights made.
Make brakes.
I have some brakes made. I've made seat posts. I've done stuff from everything from lugged bikes to TIG welded bikes to fillet brazed bikes to titanium bikes. More recently, I've been working sort of therapy. It's therapeutic for me to spend ungodly amounts of time making fancy bikes that end up being my own, because nobody will ever buy them. But the last few years I've been making, I wanted to make a titanium road bike, but I wanted it to have the same aesthetics as my lugged steel bikes. So I ended up making some titanium lugs and glued the tubes in, and I've done a couple of that way, and then the last couple bikes I've made have been titanium lugs with carbon fiber tubes that I did with Mike Lopez, who's Cerata Composites. He used to be Reynolds Composites.
Right.
And these are they're unaffordable. I mean, people always want to know how much they cost, and I always tell people, imagine what would be really expensive and multiply it times five.
And you know what? There are people who will pay that money.
Well, I haven't found any yet. But,
well, we're going to maybe get some who are listening. How would that be?
That'd be great. One of the things that I've been doing, mortality sets in, and you start thinking about how you would ever retire. I don't really want to retire. I like making stuff, but the problem, and it's no secret that I've been looking to have someone invest in my business or buy it. Unfortunately, the downside of someone buying my business is that I come with it. for about 7 or 8 years, I looked in the bike business, and everyone in the bike business these days is interested in having you design something and then having it made in Taiwan or China.
And I am against that.
I've had offers. People from Brooks wanted me to design parts for Brooks. I said, I don't want to do that. And so I'm pessimistically optimistic that there's someone who wants to be involved in the bike business. And I think the Bruce Gordon Cycles name has a certain value to it, and that the designs that I've had, most of my skills are aesthetics. They're not really, I'm not an engineer. I was an art major. So I've learned to run machines sort of crudely, but I like, what interests me these days is making things that look classic aesthetically, classic being when I started in the 70s,
right?
But yet with modern materials, because, I mean, titanium and carbon fiber are wonderful things.
Well, believe it or not, you and I have been speaking for over 30 minutes.
Okay.
And it has been, as I knew it would be, one of the funnest interviews I've done. So I want to bring you back. You know that we'll do this again. And I hope people listening got that sense of you that I know is in there, that you are just really a genius in some ways.
Well, not a genius.
Yeah,
I just like making stuff.
Well,
I would be so happy if someone were to say, hey, go in the back and make 20 bikes or make 50 racks or something. I would be, you know, but unfortunately, the way the bike business is, being a single-person operation for the most part, probably 65 or 70% of the time I spend in the office answering emails, answering the phone, you know, ordering stuff. And I really like making stuff, and I really think that I have a certain talent to take and make stuff look better than it is. And that's what my interest has been recently. So.
All right. Well, I'm going to let you go make something.
Okay.
And we will talk again soon. And are you going to be at Interbike?
Maybe.
Okay. Maybe. Then maybe I'll see you there. How's that?
Okay.
All right. Have a great night.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bruce.
It was nice talking with you.
You too.
Mm-hmm.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bruce Gordon, the one and only.
The one and only.
From Petaluma, California.
Yes.
Joined us on the Outspoken Cyclist this evening.
He did indeed.
Yeah. A friend of mine, well, a friend of yours too, Leo Foll, has a BLT, a Bruce Loaded Touring.
Well, we sold them back at the old store I had downtown, mm-hmm. Bruce Gordon's. Yeah, he makes racks.
Yeah.
Some of the most beautiful things he makes are just, they're so exquisite, they really belong in a museum.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember Leo, this is like 10 years ago, riding the Sweet Corn ride, which is one of the hilliest rides around here.
Yeah,
he rode the 50-mile route with full unsupported touring gear for some reason. I mean, he had the front and rear panniers and his sleeping roll. Oh, yeah.
What did he think? He was going to jump into a cornfield and go to bed?
He was just doing it for the heck of it.
But,
yeah, he had it all completely. I said, how can you get up these hills with all that stuff?
Oh, I've got a Bruce Gordon BLT.
Yeah,
it's got
and a very low
gearing.
Gear.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Well, that was fun.
Yes, it was. All right. Well, let's see. Next week, you're back in town.
I am in town.
With a recap of the Bike Summit.
That is true. And I am hoping to be able to have our Secretary of Transportation. We're trying to pull that together to have him weigh in after the Bike Summit.
Well,
let's get out of here,
yeah,
I guess.
Ride safely.
Yes, and you can ride.
Yeah, the weather looks good. See you next week.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at WJCU.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at WJCU.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.